Voltaire once described it as a thing that is neither holy, nor Roman, nor an empire. But none of that is really true about the Holy Roman Empire. And that's the subject of our podcast today. Hello, my name is Gareth Edwards, and welcome to the Untitled History Podcast. Join me each week alongside world-leading experts as we take a deep dive into your favorite topics from throughout history. From the ancient world to the modern, and with plenty of historical rabbit holes in between, we'll cover famous and not so famous moments in history from all across the globe. The Holy Roman Empire would exist for almost 1,000 years. In that time, it would encompass vast swathes of Europe, trigger religious wars, and result in a number of important people being thrown out of windows. Yet throughout this, it would prove almost impossible for both those inside and outside of it to define. And so to try and help me define it today, I am joined by John Ellidge. John, say hello.
Hello, how are you doing today?
I'm good. So today we are talking Holy Roman Empire, and I think it's a topic that both of us love, and I think it was a good choice, I think, for us to do together.
Yeah, so it's one of the things I kind of keep coming back to in my book, A History of the World in 47 Borders, because to an extent I wrote that book because I wanted to understand what the hell was going on with this bloody thing.
So if we're talking HRE, then the first thing we really need to talk about is the Treaty of Verdun, which is signed in August 843. So it's one of those weird forgotten treaties that has a massive impact on everything from European history for like the next 1,000 years, isn't it?
Yeah. So you think about, as you say, it's the 840s. You think about what's going on this side of the channel at that point. There is no such thing as England. There are, you know, it's still half a dozen of assorted kingdoms. The Vikings are kind of nibbling away at the edges, but that hasn't really kicked off yet. Like, this is before you get to King Alfred or any of that stuff. So this is a long, long time ago. And yet there is this treaty that divides up Europe in a way that is still, I think it's fair to say, it's still causing wars right down to the 20th century, which is mental. So to talk about this, we kind of need to go back to talk about Charlemagne, who... As I'm sure everyone will know, built this sort of new... He resurrected the Roman Empire in the West, basically. He built a massive Frankish kingdom, and then he got a pope to give him a crown as a sort of a protection racket and pretended it's because he was the new Roman emperor, which obviously delighted everyone over in Constantinople. So Charlemagne had this kingdom, or empire, depending on how you want to look at it, that's sort of bigger than any state had been since the fall of Rome, basically. So it goes from like all the way from, like, you know, Catalonia... to like well into Saxony. It's big. But then what happens is Charlemagne dies, because that tends to happen at some point to ever. I don't want to worry you. It's going to happen to you too, Gareth. So be, you know, just don't be scared. It will come. And the way the Franks divided their kingdoms upon their death, they didn't have primogeniture. So they just divided them between their children. Now, when Charlemagne died, that wasn't a problem because all but one of his sons had predeceased him. But when that son died... There were three sides to fight over it, and the result, predictably, was civil war. So you get several years of kind of like what had been quite a functional kingdom that could plausibly call itself a resurrection of the Western Empire, beating the living shit out of itself for two or three years. And eventually this all settles down. They kind of like work out what they're going to do, and they agree that they're going to split it into three bits. There's going to be a Western bit, which becomes West Francia, which is centered on what we know as Paris. And you play the tape forward, that eventually becomes France. There is East Francia, which becomes, well, as you were saying, the Holy Roman Empire. That's the bit that kind of eventually emerges into Germany. But it takes a while, and it doesn't really have a capital in the same way. And in the middle, there is a thing called Middle Francia, which is the prestigious bit, and which is bloody weird.
It's also the bit, it's very middle child. It has problems, doesn't it?
Yeah. So like the reason it's the prestigious bit is it contains Rome in the south and Aachen, which is the new imperial capital in the north. Like this is the bit with all the money, basically. This is the fancy one. But it is this kind of long, thin strip of territory that reaches all the way from Italy all the way up to Friesland. You know, it contains what we today think of as like the Netherlands and Belgium and Luxembourg and Switzerland and northern Italy. And also, and this might cue you into why it becomes a problem, as European history plays out, Alsace-Lorraine. It is basically the big West European border territory, because there is this kind of land that is, it's not French, but it's not German, and it could plausibly be either. And the result is going to be people fighting over it for the next 1,100 years.
And I find it fascinating because, I mean, you talked, as we started this off, about this isn't primogeniture. This isn't the first son inherits everything. And that is what kind of creates the problem here. And this will be familiar, frankly, to any listeners. If any of you play games like Crusader Kings 2 or 3, you will have had that moment where you started playing, where you've built yourself a nice empire, you've got three or four sons, and then your character dies and suddenly the empire goes to hell. And that really is what has happened in this before we get to this final treaty, that creates some kind of agreement as to how things will go forward.
Yeah, I mean, primogeniture has problems because sometimes the eldest son is an idiot or a coward or something. They're just in some way not suited. But what it does do is it removes the uncertainty from the system. Whereas, like, you know, under the Frankish system of partible inheritance, where they split it, firstly, everyone's going to argue over which bit they get. They're going to argue over where the borders are between those bits. You're just setting yourself up for like a civil war and the succession crisis every time anyone dies. There is a system somewhere in between. I can't remember the term for it, but where it's not primogeniture, it's not kind of guaranteed to go to the firstborn son. A sort of elective monarchy, I suppose, where like, you know, someone will get the lot, but you don't know who's going to get the lot. So then too, you kind of have the civil war.
You get the opposite situation in certain instances where, well, the thing you need to avoid is what you end up with in Bohemia at certain points, which is where the oldest person who is eligible inherits, which is one of those principles that seems good on paper because you're going to get someone who's experienced and they've been around the block a bit. But in reality, what they quickly find is it means you get a string of very elderly men on the throne who die very quickly, and you just get chaos as a result.
I mean, that's sort of what Saudi Arabia was doing until quite recently, I think, wasn't it? Although, like, it does, the career of MBS does suggest that, like, switching to the next generation doesn't magically magic up any liberal reforms or anything, does it? But yeah, like, this is a problem. What you do with your kingdom when somebody dies is, like, one of the key problems of European history. And it's not, I think, a problem that actually has an easy solution. Like, the period of Rome that they call the kind of the five good emperors, they sort of tumbled into quite a good solution where, like, because Rome had this very strong sense of what adoption meant. So everyone picked the successor and adopted them. So you get this kind of succession of emperors who are quite well qualified. They're quite clever. They know what they're doing. But that falls to bits the moment Marcus Aurelius actually has a legitimate son who plausibly can inherit. And the son in question becomes the bad guy in the film Gladiator, which is a sign of how well that goes.
I mean, so, As we've talked about, the Treaty of Verdun effectively sets up over 1,000 years of European arguing over the middle bit of Europe. But it kind of creates, ultimately, is we get that initial partition, that long-term partition, where what will eventually become France is on one side, and what will eventually become modern Germany, but via various things on the way, on the other side. And it's sort of those various things on the way that we're talking about here, which is one of the most fascinating combinations of borders that you get in Europe. And so maybe let's do the wiggly lines jump here and say that things kind of go a bit okay and a bit badly for a while, and then everything splits apart again. And then we get to about 962, when Otto of Saxony, he also finds himself a pope who is happy to put a crown on his head. And he is really the first person to be crowned as Roman emperor in what will become the Holy Roman Empire going forward, isn't he?
Yeah. So what I find interesting about this is he is copying Charlemagne to get his legitimacy in the same way that Charlemagne had been copying the Roman emperors to get his legitimacy. So you can just kind of see how, like, the importance of precedent as kind of a historical force is like, well, this must be fine because that guy did it.
One of the strengths that Otto brings to this is that he brings strength to it. And as you've said already, what you're seeing here is precedent. What we're seeing is a following on from Charlemagne. It's saying, look, I am as strong as Charlemagne was. I should be crowned. I'm going to bring some kind of order to what is rapidly becoming a sort of decentralizing, disintegrating area of what was previously East Francia. And I'm going to pull it back together and make it properly East Francia again, and I'm going to make it an empire. And that starts to set the scene, really, of things in what we would now call Germany, in Austria, in that border territory, again, as you say, with the area of what become Lotharingia, that middle ground, of things starting to accrue together to become what will become known as the Holy Roman Empire.
I mean, it does take quite a while. I think also there is a danger of kind of sort of Whiggishly reading backwards here. That's the exact opposite of Whiggish history, isn't it? Never mind, just keep that in, that's fine, I don't care. there is a danger of kind of reading history backwards, because obviously, like, we know that the Holy Roman Empire is going to become this bit that's kind of like a bit crumbly. It doesn't work very well as a centralized state. But for a lot of this period, neither does France, or what becomes France. Like, the reason you get something that we call the Angevin Empire, where, like, Henry II of England is also running most of what we think of as Western France, is that he is technically answerable to that territory, to the King of France. Like, the King of France is his liege lord. But because it's Henry who has all the actual power, that doesn't work. Like, you know, feudalism is, to an extent, an attempt to put a label on a complicated system that's just raw power politics. It's like there is kind of no central administration. There is kind of like no, there is no kind of legalistic way of doing things. It is just like the power you can exert through whatever means you have at your disposal. And sometimes that is a massive army. Sometimes it's taxes. Sometimes it's religious, but often it's nothing at all. And you've just got to sort of persuade people or watch them break away. Hello, cat.
Yeah. Our research assistant has arrived. And the breakaway and joining is a thing that will become a feature of the, even the name, the Holy Roman Empire, like, it's not what it's called when it starts. It's very rarely, if ever, actually officially referred to as that right up until or towards the end. Or if it is, it has extra bits thrown on the end or thrown on the beginning. And I think that's, listeners, something to consider here is that this really is a sort of grouping based as much on precedent and the political power of, as it grows or wanes, of individual rulers. For the next sort of, well, I mean, again, like for almost 1,000 years, really. But it's the 1300s, isn't it, when maybe we can probably say is the peak of the Holy Roman Empire.
Yeah, around then. I mean, like, so the late medieval period and then kind of the early modern period, it's kind of like, it is the big power in Europe. It is the one with which France is going to compete for dominance, basically. So, you know, if you've ever read or watched the adaptation of Wolf Hall, and you know, Cromwell is constantly worrying about what the emperor thinks, this is the emperor that we're talking about here. Now, by then, it's kind of becoming something a bit different because due to a series of clever marriage decisions on the part of the Habsburg, or bad marriage decisions on the part of everyone in Spain, the same guy has ended up ruling over the Holy Roman Empire and Spain and large chunks of the New World and a lot of southern Italy and a bunch of other kingdoms. And that's Charles V. So you can kind of get into this argument as to whether it's...
And he also has a decent claim on the throne of England by this point as well. And everyone's going, well, actually, hang on, maybe we should shut this down a bit.
Yeah. I mean, his son is briefly King of England, which we pretend he wasn't. But like when Philip II of Spain marries Queen Mary, he is king. That is what all the documentation says. It's like he's sort of like a male equivalent of a queen consort. He's not a king regnant, a term that no one's ever needed before. But he is basically, his title is king. He's not like, you know, prince regent or something. That is kind of the peak of the power of the Holy Roman Empire. And it does kind of like start falling away at that point, because it's always, as with all these feudal states, like it's not a centralized unit. It's almost a franchise system, isn't it? You kind of got the lords that report to you, and then there's the knights that report to them, and so on. And if you've got a strong king, that kind of works. What starts going wrong in the 16th century is a lot of the lords work out that, like, if they switch religions, they no longer need to answer to that bastard over there. So they all start becoming Protestant, because that way they don't have to go, well, you've been crowned by the Pope, therefore I have to respect your authority. But, you know, to some extent, like, the Reformation is driven by a lot of German lords realizing that this will give them greater power in their own domain. And so, like, to the extent that the empire did work as a centralized state, it all starts falling to bits.
And when we say the German lords, we literally mean the German lords. I think sometimes there's a tendency for people to imagine that maybe the Holy Roman Empire is a collection of large kingdoms all operating under a sort of loose crown of an empire. We're not really talking about. You've got a few large bodies within this. You've got things like the Archduchy of Austria, which again is a totally made up thing that they came up with because they just wanted to come up with a word that wasn't king. You've got Prussia starting to come together by this point, but certainly Brandenburg exerting power. You've got Bohemia as a relatively large state.
A kingdom, I think.
Yeah, actually. But I mean, Bohemia is the one kingdom that exists with this up until you get the king in Prussia, which again is this massive fudge because Prussians want to have a king, but everyone says, well, no, you're not allowed to have kings in the empire anymore. So you have, I think, the king in Prussia rather than the king of Prussia, which is where suddenly words really matter. But outside of those key bodies, what you end up with is a lot of tiny duchies of, as the empire grows, you get the free cities. This is a real, real melting pot of different microcultures almost, and this combination of very powerful lords and the odd king and the odd duke, and everyone really trying to work out how they get the most out of it for themselves.
Yeah, I mean, so something we should, I want to come on to talk about some of kind of the mini states in a second, but something I think we probably should clarify is that, like, going back to the succession crisis thing, it is an elective monarchy. Like, there are the reasons, like, you get these phrases like the Elector of Hanover, Sophia, Electress of Hanover, is like that Hanover is at that point, one of the places that gets to pick the emperor of the Holy Roman Empire. There's generally seven of them. And they are people like the King of Bohemia and like the Archbishop of Mainz and these places. However, from sometime in the 15th century, the person they elect every time is just the next most senior person in the House of Habsburg. And that happens repeatedly for centuries, therefore rendering the whole idea of it being elective completely irrelevant. So technically, like, that's another sort of mechanism through which the emperor does not have kind of like supreme royal authority. But it does kind of like break into these increasingly ridiculous fractions, doesn't it? So you get these tiny things, like you've mentioned the kind of free cities, which, you know, we can envision what a free city would be because, you know, we are aware of the existence of, for example, Singapore. We know what, you know, a city that works as a state looks like. However, in the Holy Roman Emperor, you also get things like the Abbey of Prüm, which is just a Benedictine monastery, which has lots and lots of land, but its main asset is actually the sandals of Jesus, which it lets you have a peek at for a few coins. Or there's another sort of monastic one that's a nunnery, I think, the Imperial Free Secular Foundation of Gandersheim, which is what all the noble families do with their unmarried daughters. They just shove them in this nunnery and they get to be part of this sort of free state under the Holy Roman Emperor.
Oh, I mean, the House of Raus is one of my favourite. I mean,
I love the House of Raus. It's Royce, but yes.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I always go with Raus because I can never not pronounce it like it's Disney. to explain for people, this is effectively in Thuringia, which is sort of the, again, the think the middle-ish bit again of what would be Germany, is that you've effectively got almost two micro duchies. Both from the same family, but one's an offshoot family. But it's the Emperor Heinrich who gives them their first bite of power. And they effectively swear beyond that they're just going to name every single son after that Heinrich, don't they?
They do. So that's in about the 12th, 13th century. Like Heinrich the Sixth is very nice to them. So they just kind of name every, from then on, every boy child born to the family is named Heinrich, regardless of how many Heinrichs you've already got. And there's another problem, which is like, you know, the going back to sort of the succession crisis, primogeniture stuff, the territory keeps fracturing into more and more bits. So there's generally two or three of them, but often there's kind of more bits. And then as if all that wasn't silly enough, all the Heinrichs are numbered, whether or not they are in charge. So there's points where there's like Heinrich the 17th is ruling, and then the next kingdom over, there's like Heinrich the 26th and Heinrich the 48th up the road.
And to make it even worse, I mean, because I looked into this once because I was just got a bit obsessed with the numbering, is effectively both of the two main branches of the family decide that they're going to treat their reset point for their numbering completely differently. So one branch resets it at the beginning of every century. So if you're born the first Heinrich in a century, you become Heinrich the first again. But the other branch of the family just says, well, whenever we get to Heinrich the 100th, at that point we will reset. So they haven't even agreed on how they're going to reset their Heinrichs. And there's just Heinrichs everywhere by this point.
Just also imagine how that family meeting went. They're just kind of like sat around just like, you know, tearing their hair out, trying to think of a solution to this problem of like the number of the Heinrichs. And at no point does anyone sort of stick their hand up and go, could we try a different name?
The fun thing is
Can we maybe do a Peter?
Yeah, they're still doing it today. They're still around and they're still doing it. In fact, one of the things that I love is that, I'm not going to remember his number, but one of the more recent Heinrichs was a wee bit of a Nazi during World War II. German ex-aristocrat.
A German noble who had Nazi sympathies, yeah. My God.
So he, but post-war, he ends up in a Soviet camp and dies there. And the Soviets seize all of the lands that they can for that. And then obviously the German state have done the same thing. And so all of the Rus lands pass into the control of the German state, and they're still in the control of the German state after unification. But that Heinrich's wife is still alive. She's well into her 90s at this point, but she's still around and she wants her land back. And she successfully petitions the German state by pointing out that her Heinrich, that one from World War II, his mother, I think, is British, and therefore he's entitled to British citizenship for various reasons. And because he's a British citizen, not just a German citizen, they're not allowed even then to seize his land because it's owned by a foreign person. This goes to court, it goes all the way through, and eventually she gets two castles and like a whole bunch of paintings from the National Gallery back. So that's why they now still today as a house have a whole bunch of castles and a whole bunch of artwork again, because she right into her 90s was like, no, I'm damn well getting all of this back. So yeah, again, these ripples of the empire that just last forever.
I'm shocked and stunned to learn that the British state is defending the interests of over-entitled posh people.
To be fair, I don't think the state did that. I think she just did it on her behalf of going like, there's a weird clause in the rules even the Soviets had on what stuff they could seize, which was you can take stuff off the German people, but don't take it off of anyone else. And she just basically did the genealogy trick of going, well, I think you'll find my husband was technically British and therefore you couldn't take anything off of him. This is the thing, these ripples, these legacies of the empire, of the Holy Roman Empire, and as you say, like the Treaty of Verdun, you know, that will continue to have this impact on European history right the way through. I mean, you touched earlier a bit on once we hit that point where the Reformation happens and religion starts to get involved. And it is as much about power as it is about religion. And that triggers something really that we get into, which is the 30 Years' War, which starts in about 1618, and it will continue to roughly 1648, partly because the Swedes decide they want part of this as well. But that really is the point where you start getting this north-south divide in the empire, isn't it? The Reformation is the point where we start getting things to divide along religious lines. And we're going to talk about the 30 Years' War in a second, but before that, we should really talk about the Treaty of Augsburg, shouldn't we?
Yeah, so the Peace of Augsburg is, I think, 1555. So you've got this first wave of religious wars in the Reformation where, like, basically the emperor is going, like, you know, you are Catholic and I am your overlord. And all the sort of mini lords in the empire are going, no, we're not, and no, you aren't. That is kind of that is basically what's going on in Germany in the 16th century. And eventually they kind of agree that the Peace of Augsburg, under which each individual territory of the empire will have the religion of its lord. Like, basically, like, if the lord decides to convert, then that territory is now Protestant. And that kind of brings about, you know, several decades of peace. But it's obviously cut the emperor off at the knees, because they can no longer go, well, you have to do what I say because I'm anointed by the Pope. They say, well, I'm not a Catholic. I don't have to do anything because the Pope said it. So at that point, like, the empire is already weakening. And also, I think, like, you know, the Habsburg power kind of peaks under Charles V, doesn't it? And then, like, when he doesn't even die immediately, does he? He just gets knackered and goes and retires to a monastery.
Yeah, he kind of turns around and goes, you know what, I've had enough of this. I'm just gonna retire, lads. I'm gonna find a bit more work-life balance.
I mean, he dies quite quickly, so I wonder if he did have some kind of, like, chronic thing that kills him. But, like, his empire, which is one of the largest the world has ever seen, because it includes much of the Americas by that point, in theory at least, gets split between his brother and his son. So his son takes Spain and the Spanish lands, and also, confusingly, the Netherlands. And his brother takes the rest, which is, you know, the actual empire bit. So, like, you know, already, like, Habsburg power is kind of peaked. The emperor is not as strong a figure as they once were. The Spanish bit spends the next 80 years fighting the Dutch, who've decided they don't really want to be ruled from Madrid, because just look at a map, that's stupid. And then you get to 1618, which is my favourite event in the whole of European... Well, no, it's not my favourite event. My favourite fact about the whole of European history is 1618 is the year of the defenestration of Prague. Can you guess what my favourite fact is going to be?
No, you go for it.
It is that the event known to European history as the defenestration of Prague should more properly be known as the second or possibly the third defenestration of Prague. Because this was just the sort of thing that happened quite a lot in Prague. It's like occasionally someone important will get chucked out of a window, and it was 50-50 whether that was going to lead to a major European war. So in the 15th century, the one that was definitely the first defenestration of Prague led to a Hussite war over some kind of like early sort of pseudo-Protestant Jan Hus.
It's just sort of religious rebellion and war that kicks off, primarily focused around Bohemia, for those who are unfamiliar with it. And it's almost proto-Protestantism kicking in. And as you say, it's one of several events that's triggered by people being thrown out of windows.
Yeah. It's sort of the soft launch of the Reformation. It's like, well, that didn't work, so we'll do it again. We'll get this Martin Luther guy to nail something to a tree. But 1618, I can never remember which way round it is. It's the Catholics who are thrown out the window, isn't it?
I'm pretty certain it's the Catholics who are thrown out of the window. There's so many people are getting thrown out of windows at various points.
They're thrown out of this window in Prague Castle, which you can still go and see. I've seen it. It's a couple of stories up, but they survive because, well, the Catholic line is that they are guided to the ground by a host of angels and therefore miraculously survive. The Protestant line is they landed in a heap of dung. But either way, they don't die. But this outrage kind of sparks a war against Bohemia, which kind of gradually expands to fill the whole of Central Europe. And, you know, every time it looks like it's winding down, another army will appear on the horizon because they've spotted there's an advantage here. If they kind of go in and fight on one side or the other. So the French, who are incredibly Catholic, one of the most Catholic powers in Europe, actually take the Protestant side for reasons of political advantage. And the Swedes turn up under Gustavus Adolphus. And like, it's very bad. It's a very bad time to be a German, basically, because armies keep coming through, eating all your crops and killing everyone. And it goes on for 30 years.
And it's a particularly bad time if you're in North Germany, as you say, because just as things start to calm down, or you think they're calming down, oh, great, another Swedish army has just turned up and Gustavus Adolphus has decided he wants to try out his brand new battle tactics for this year on your entire civilian population. But I think this speaks to almost both the chaos, but also the loose connections that still remain. That you'd expect, like, there would be no overarching political entity that would still continue to exist through this. But because the Holy Roman Empire in all its forms had always been a somewhat loose coalition of everything, there's never really a question throughout this about dissolving the Holy Roman Empire. It's all just about, where do I sit within it? Where is the control in it? And there's also still elements of expansion going on within this. I mean, there's an apologies to German listeners here. But there's, throughout this whole period, you've got something that's called the Ostsiedlung, which is this shift eastward of large German populations. It's been going on since the 13th century. And each time they manage to accrue a certain amount of power in an area, particularly in what we'd now call Poland, they come together, a duke is proclaimed, and they go, by the way, lads, we're in the Holy Roman Empire now. You can't come and get us to Poland, because if you come and get us, the emperor's going to get you. And this goes on for centuries as the empire sorts of expands. It does the same thing with the Teutonic Knights territory and what will become East Prussia. So the empire is both growing and trying to pull itself apart at various points throughout its entire existence, but also sometimes simultaneously.
Yeah, and you end up with, there's a whole succession of places that sort of have like one foot in the empire and one foot outside. So sort of the Netherlands is like that, or what becomes Netherlands. Switzerland's a bit like that. Austria is sort of like that. Like, well, Austria is kind of, to the extent the empire has a capital, it's Vienna. And yet, like, the House of Habsburg just starts collecting lands outside the empire, but attached to Vienna. So you end up with all these places where, like, you know, they still are kind of under the umbrella of the empire, but they also have a lot of their power outside. And that kind of gives them greater influence than the emperor.
And that happens in trade terms as well, because you get this situation where at various points, Riga claims to be part of the Holy Roman Empire.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I mean, it never is really in any form, but it doesn't stop them turning around and publishing a whole bunch of stuff claiming that they are in it, particularly whenever the Swedes are hanging around looking greedy. But they try and claim it through their association with the Hanseatic League, through their at times religious similarities, but they make a strong case to say, look, we are an imperial city, and that's Riga sitting in what is modern Latvia. And so it shows that for actually a lot of those periphery states, there is almost a value still in turning around and being able to say, look, I am part of the empire. We have that tradition. We have that collective identity.
Well, the Holy Roman Empire is really more of a vibe than an institution, isn't it? I mean, like when you were saying When we were talking about at the end of the 30 Years' War, and which ends in a thing called the Peace of Westphalia, which everyone's probably heard of, but that kind of like gives...
We should summarise the Peace of Westphalia, by the way, as saying it's the point where everyone just really goes, you know what? We're never going to end this. We're all really tired. Let's just agree to disagree, which is effectively what happens after 30 years of fighting, as everyone goes, let's just agree to disagree.
At that point, the emperor is entirely nominal, basically. It's not actually true that all these tiny states were ever independent in the way like England or France are. But nonetheless, they can conduct independent foreign policy. It would be like the Isle of Man being a crown dependency that nonetheless can make a peace treaty with Russia or something. It makes no sense. But this is what you end up with after Westphalia. But as you've already alluded to, at no point is anyone saying, shall we just get rid of this whole emperor thing? Like, nobody even thinks about that. And I kind of think like a good parallel might be the way that like no matter how much trouble the British royal family get into, support for republicanism in this country is about 7% or something ridiculous. Like no one can be bothered to have the conversation. It's just like, well, obviously they're just there. And I think it's the same kind of vibe that like everyone is like happy having a completely pointless emperor who has no, you know, only nominal power and can't actually do anything. But no one's thinking about getting rid of him. It's just ceremonial. And that's when you get the one thing that everybody knows about the Holy Roman Empire is that annoyingly pithy Voltaire quote where he says, you know, it's neither holy nor Roman nor an empire.
Yeah, I think the exact quote is this body, which was called and which still calls itself the Holy Roman Empire, was in no way holy nor Roman nor an empire. All three, which is very pithy and to a certain extent is true when he's talking about it.
It's true in the 18th century, yeah. But it was, you know, if you go back a few centuries, that's deeply unfair.
Yeah.
Like, it was Roman in that it included Rome for a while. And not by this point, but for a long time, Rome was part of the Holy Roman Empire. And it was also Roman in that it was, you know, explicitly a successor to the Western Empire. It was holy because the Pope crowns the emperor. And it was an empire because it was massive. All these things were true. It's just that by the time you get to Voltaire's time in the 18th century, this place is a joke.
But it's a joke that still continues to exist and at that point. And that's what I do find fascinating, as you say. By that point, it's an empire almost based on vibes. It's a collective transnational identity that is very useful and gives a basic underlying principle as to why we should all trade with each other and why we should visit that Duke one over and why we maybe don't need to accrue under certain large kingdoms. We can have a degree of perceived independence.
I'm going to push back on the idea it was a transnational identity because I think that's ahistorical.
Yeah, fair.
I don't think you can have a transnational identity before anyone has really invented the concept of the nation state, and that's sort of a product of the
19th century. Yeah, I get that. I can see that as being fair.
I think we project it back further than it goes because England and France do both have like 1,000 years of history, but actually in much of Europe it just doesn't work like that.
Well, and actually, in fairness, building on that point, one thing I always talk about with regard to the First World War is everyone talks about the German army in the First World War. Well, the German army in the First World War is four armies in a trench coat. Like, it's the Bohemian army, it's the Saxon army, it's the wider, the Volks army of civilians called up, and it's the freaking Prussians. Like, so, and that in itself is, again, a legacy of this period. Those, even after the unification of Germany and the creation of Germany as a state, those legacies of structures of the HRE, of decentralized structures that existed at that time, are still present and consistent in the First World War, a war that is being fought in many ways, largely over a bunch of territory that we talked about that's designed right back in that original treaty and will cause trouble for the next 1,000 years. So even after it's gone, the Holy Roman Empire is still exerting elements of some kind of identity and control and vibe onto the German state at the time.
Well, if you think about the rise of the EU and what it was, you know, the origin of the European Union and like the European coal and steel community, the explicit purpose of it was to make war between France and Germany over those middle territories impossible. The EU exists as a response to the Treaty of Verdun. That is mad, but it is kind of true.
Well, we should talk about, we've mentioned that by the First World War, it's no longer existing. And obviously that is 1914 when all this is kicking off. And we've talked a bit about Voltaire and saying, you know, actually by the time he's talking about this, it's on shaky ground. And that is, as you said, we're entering the 18th century. It's really the very first years of the 19th century where it all starts to come finally comes apart. And that's largely thanks to everyone's favorite or least favorite emperor, Napoleon himself, isn't it?
Yeah, so I have a very un-British soft spot for Napoleon, because he is a man who looked at maps, thought, that is stupid, I'm going to tidy this up. And I have a lot of sympathy with that impulse. And he basically just kind of goes to it, as well as like the military conquests and the enforcement of Napoleonic codes in the metric system and so on. He also just tries to make the map of Europe a lot more rational. And one of the things he does is looks at the Holy Roman Empire and goes, this is stupid, and gets rid of it. So in, I think it's 1806, after nigh on 1,000 years of history, it's done.
Yeah, I mean, the last Holy Roman Emperor...
But it's with a whimper, really.
Yeah, I mean, the last Holy Roman Emperor is Emperor Francis II. And as you say, like, it's after he loses the Battle of Austerlitz in 1805. Napoleon is like, this is my chance. Now we can stop this. And I do think it almost speaks to how much of a vibe thing it was. But once it's gone, even though people like the idea and still talk about it and like some of the principles it has, there's never really an effort to bring it back. It is a thing that is kind of like, well, now we've lost it. We're not in a really big rush to bring it back.
Well, it's completely irrelevant by then. I mean, if you think about the interminable, endless, broadly interchangeable wars you get in the 18th century, we've got like the Seven Years' War and the Nine Years' War and the War of the Spanish Succession, the War of Austrian Succession. I can never remember which is which, what order they come in, who's allied with who. But in all the descriptions I've ever heard of any of them, you talk about like which side Austria is on. You don't talk about which side the Holy Roman Empire is on. Because like by that point, the kind of the power base is, it's the same people, it's the same emperor, but we refer to them as the Austrians because their real power base is in their territories outside the empire, as well as Vienna. So like, even though in that period, the Holy Roman Empire still exists, it's just an irrelevance. It's just a title by then. So I think when Napoleon does get rid of it, there's nobody alive who sees why you would bring it back, really.
Yeah, that's when you get this split into, and it doesn't stop. Individual German states and microstates coming together to form closer allegiances. It doesn't stop them. You end up with almost two spheres of influence over time. You end up, as you say, with the Austrian sphere of influence and the Prussian sphere of influence, and you get the North German Confederation forming. And that will eventually effectively keep eating on things, including Austria eventually, until it becomes what we now think of as Germany today. But yeah, I just always find the Holy Roman Empire fascinating, precisely because it's a thing that was important, but the way it was important just seemed to change massively over time and based on who was in charge and where the power balance in Europe lay. It was never really that it was defined by itself. It was almost always defined by people within it and the outside factors on it.
I think for much of history, that's true. I mean, I think like, so one of the reasons I really like the sort of the George R. R. Martin Westeros stuff, like the Game of Thrones universe, is because it does kind of like rip the sort of mask of this stuff and show that these institutions are irrelevant. It's all entirely personal power politics. Under any sort of system that we would refer to as feudalism, it's not actually about systems of law or institutions. It is purely about who can assert their will. And that is based more on like, you know, things like charisma and wealth and personal alliances and so on. And that is how European history functions until the early modern period, really. And like the Holy Roman Empire is kind of a relic of that era. So even though, you know, as late as the early 16th century, it's this incredibly powerful entity. It's far more important than England. It's arguably more important than France. But within like a century and a half after that, it's literally a joke. And it's just that the world has left it behind because we moved into a politics of kind of like more legalistic state formation. So it is just kind of like a relic of an earlier era. And by the time you get to Voltaire, he's right. It's a joke. But it wasn't always. And I think it's important we remember that because it does have legacies today.
And I do, I mean, as I'm a strategy gamer, I love my Europa Universalis 4 and my Crusader Kings 3 and all this kind of thing. And one thing I've
never got into any of that stuff, and that's in large part because I suspect if they did, no one would ever see me again.
Yeah, I mean, never look at my Steam account and spot the 4,000 plus hours I've spent playing Europa Universalis 4. But one thing I find fascinating with those games as a historian is you look at things like the forums for those games when Paradox, the studio that does it, releases them and everything else. And I remember vividly years ago seeing a post on a forum that basically turned around and went, this game is broken. I'm playing as Sweden. The 30 Years' War has started. I won the war, but now I've been crowned as emperor, and I don't want to be emperor because now I have to defend everything, and there's no way for me to stop being emperor. This game is bugged. It's broken. And I'm like, no. That's a feature. That's absolutely something that could conceivably happen within the framework of the Holy Roman Empire. And you could absolutely see the Swedish king, if it was Gustavus Adolphus or anyone, having exactly the same reaction, which is, wait, no, I didn't want to be emperor. I didn't want to be in charge of this thing. I just wanted to go over there and have some fun and do things and assert some personal power for a while.
Well, it's also, I mean, to kind of like close the circle, it's built in at the very beginning. If you kind of think of Middle Francia, Lotharingia, whatever you want to call it, that middle territory that goes from like essentially Tuscany in the south to Friesland in the north. That is, as I alluded to, it's the prestigious bit because it's got Roman archon in it. But it's also long and thin and indefensible. And there's Saracens attacking it in the south and Vikings attacking it in the north. It's a poison chalice, even though it's the bit that like the eldest brother got it because it's the one with all the good stuff. And it is just immediately in crisis because it just doesn't work as a state. And that just kind of feels like a good metaphor for the whole thing for the next 1,000 years.
And I think it's also a good metaphor for its continuation of Romanness in a way, because ultimately it's the flaw that Rome will always have. Is that how do you communicate? Empires are defined by the logistical reach they can exert. And that middle Lotharingia always has that problem. But also has that, you get a weird reverse period where it becomes an incredibly useful route for the Spanish to get to the Netherlands based on old treaties and everything else every time they need to move an army up there.
Was this the Spanish roads?
Yeah. I mean, we'll absolutely do a whole episode on the Spanish road, which is just fascinating in itself. But listeners, the very short version of that is, if you need to get troops from Spain to the Netherlands and England doesn't like you and is controlling the seas and France doesn't like you and is controlling the seas, then effectively you have to go the long way around, which means you go through the Mediterranean, you go into Italy and you go up through that very middle territory we've just talked about. And that happens multiple times for Spanish armies and it becomes known as the Spanish Road. And it's absolutely fascinating. We'll go into that point. But that in itself, again, is another legacy and a thing that exists because of the HRE. And so, yeah, I think, This is one of those episodes that was always going to be a bit slightly jumping around a bit, but I always felt that like that's almost in character for the topic we're talking about here. So, John, thank you very much for doing this for our episode. I know it's a rabbit hole that you've fallen down as much as I have, and that's why I wanted to do it with yourself. Listeners, don't forget that subscribe. Tell us, review us if you like the podcast. All of those things help spread the word. But John, also, before we do the extra bit for our subscribing listeners, where can people find you if they're unfamiliar with your work?
I cover about two-thirds of the internet at this point, so I'm fairly unavoidable.
I personally will highly recommend you subscribe to John's newsletter. It is excellent, and it is full of very genuine and useful information and absolute rabbit holes that listeners of this podcast will love.
It is just the contents of my brain. So there's a lot of history. There's a lot of weird geography. There's just like, I have a question I want answered. I'm going to monetize it by writing 800 words in it for a newsletter. And there's a bit of politics and so on. But that's it. It's called The Newsletter of Not Quite Everything. It's on Substack at John, which is JONN, just because I like to be difficult. JONN.substack.com.
And books. I mean, there's a very obvious book that we should give a shout out to in relevance as we've been talking about borders here.
Yeah, The History of the World in 47 Borders is my last book, which, again, is available in all good bookshops and also some terrible ones. That also, for a while, was covering like two-thirds of the Earth, which was delightful as an author. My new one, which I'm frantically trying to finish now, is not about borders. It's going to be called 35 Inventions That Changed Our World or Made Our World. I don't know. They change the title every 5 minutes at this point in the process. But it's basically a history of the urban world. So kind of starting with the urban revolution and why we started living in cities and kind of working through like, you know, heating and air conditioning and, you know, sewers and water and skyscrapers and escalators and lifts and then doing a load of nerdy transport stuff and maps and signage and so on. So that's out in August if I can actually finish it.
Years ago, pre-COVID, sadly he's no longer with us, but there used to be an elevator museum in New York. And the guy who ran it had worked in the elevator industry for decades and everything else. And he wrote a very good little book. It's not very well written, but it's a very good book. It's one of those ones that's a work of love. And he effectively, his entire theory was New York's existence and its growth periods are entirely defined by elevator technology. Because it's every single time someone invents a new way of going up a few floors quickly that New York expands and grows. And it's a fascinating thing. So I'm very much looking forward to your book. Right. Well, listeners, regular listeners, thank you very much for listening. As I say, don't forget to recommend us to your friends. Subscribers, and you can subscribe at untitled-history.com. You now get the extra bit, which is where John and I chat a bit more nonsense that in theory is vaguely related to the HRE for about 10 more minutes. You've been listening to the Untitled History Podcast, a Battle Guide production. If you've enjoyed this episode and would like to support the podcast, why not head over to our dedicated supporter page? There, for the cost of a cup of tea, you can decide which subjects we cover next, get access to exclusive behind-the-scenes content, and join a community of like-minded people. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.